So I have a few bits and pieces I want to share. A little bit about practice, a little bit about living in the world. And then I thought I'll do some Q&A. I was going to do Q&A at the end of the day, but I think it's actually useful to do a little Q&A and then have some time to sit with the answers, because otherwise you're just rushing back away again. So I thought I'd do a little bit this afternoon. So, in what order? This is about being a Dharma practitioner, really living this way. Alan Watts, The Art of Living. I like that, because it's like, I think meditation is an art. Becoming a meditator is this increasingly refining art, the art of living. The art of living is neither careless drifting on the one hand, nor a fearful clinging to the past on the other. It consists in being sensitive to each moment, regarding each moment as utterly new and unique, and having the mind open and wholly receptive. Should have read that this morning. I've got another Hafiz poem, and then a Hafiz kick. Hafiz, in the way he spoke, he talk about God. He used God, which a Buddhist would use maybe the Dharma, or the truth, or the divine truth. And Hafiz also talks about the beloved, meaning connecting with the divinity, really. It's not Buddhist language, but that's okay. What's the difference between your experience of existence and that of a sage? The sage knows that the spiritual path is a sublime chess game with the divine, and that the beloved has just made such a fantastic move that the sage is now continuously tripping over joy and bursting out in laughter and saying, "I surrender, I surrender." Whereas, my dear, I'm afraid you still think you have 1,000 serious moves. We take ourselves so seriously. That's speaking really to the sense of like trust the unfolding, trust that your awareness will reveal to you and you'll understand and become more. Whereas we have to be so good and work so hard and try. And it's sweet of us, but a little too serious. Yes. So if you want, I have no idea where I got this. You collect these things on this kind of occupation. If you want happiness for an hour, take a nap. If you want happiness for a day, go fishing. If you want happiness for a month, get married. If you want happiness for a year, inherit a fortune. If you want happiness for a lifetime, understand yourself. So now I have a couple of things to say about living this art of living in this crazy world that we're in, with these turbulent times that we're in. There's a couple of just small pieces I want to say. We talked about this a bit last night, some of us. How can the Dharma help? How can having the Dharma in our lives, the truth in our lives, accessing this, help in these, you know, particularly turbulent times that we're in and potentially going to be in? And I think there are three really serious applications of this, if you like, or ways that this helps us. And one of them is being able to let ourselves feel upset, let ourselves feel afraid, let ourselves really feel if there's been some injustice, some things are going on that we absolutely, you know, are upsetting for us, worrying us, and so on. Policies, for instance, coming down, the changing in regulations of things, the evicting of things or people, you know, that, or whatever it is. But to be able to get in touch truly, really feel, let in, allow ourselves to connect with being upset or afraid or whatever. Because we tend not to want to feel it, and we tend to readily go to preventing ourselves from feeling it by blaming or by complaining or something, because we're trying to avoid the upset. And that's not skillful, because we're not really in touch with how we are and how we feel, and we're not in touch with our awareness, which can help us make proactive, whatever it is, actions, statements. So it supports us to be able to stay here, honestly, as I was saying this morning, and let yourself feel what you feel. Kindly hold yourself tenderly and allow ourselves to get in touch, because it's hard to do. And it feels counterproductive. It doesn't feel counterintuitive even. It doesn't feel like that's what I want to do, is really feel upset. But let ourselves really get to know what we're really feeling and what's really going on in us, where I'm at. Get to know ourselves in that way, so that any further steps come from clarity and from steadiness rather than from, you know, trying to avoid or being unstable. And this is a huge thing I've just said. Because it's not just in these turbulent times, it's in our lives in general. Can we, in fact, let ourselves feel how we're feeling when we're in an argument or when we're in any kind of a distress? Let it in fully. Let ourselves really know, yeah, this is what it's like. Just the moment's experience of it. Huge, hugely essential, really, for pro-action. You know, for being able to speak what's true, for being in touch with what's true for me. This is what's true for me. I feel like this. Unless we're in touch with what's true for me, then we're confused in our behavior. And then if it's in a negative scenario, we're just adding more confusion and more negativity. And when we're part of the problem, we are the people who can reduce the problem by it even just being centered enough to know what's happening. So that's one hugely important piece. Another hugely important piece is remembering, and I've already mentioned it, but I'm just doing this again, is as we practice, the more we practice, we get these various insights bubbling up. An insight that we get bubbling up over and over is this realization, I've said it before, that nothing is happening sort of in a vacuum. Nothing is happening by choice. Everything that's arising, people, their opinions, their statements, everything, the roles we play, the words coming out of our mouth, are conditioned to be that way. Everything, conditionality. When we experience it in ourselves, we'll see something. And we'll just, the mind is able to become stable, the attention gets more stable, and we see, for example, in my case, I remember I was in retreat in Massachusetts, where there's the big center, IMS, and they have long retreats in the fall. And so in the fall is when the leaves fall. So I'm watching these leaves fall, and they're beautiful. Lots of them are these vine maples and beautiful colors, you know, the east and its colors. So watching this tree change color over the weeks, watching particularly one afternoon, I remember it really well, this leaf falling. I mean, I'm standing under the tree watching it with completely stable attention. And then a leaf lets go, and then it comes down and comes down and comes down and comes down. And then I see the leaf on the ground, and then I see all of its fellow leaves on the ground. And as my attention, because it can stays, I realize that the leaf, there are other leaves, and leaves that are older leaves that have been there longer, and then some that have been there really a long time. And I start to see that what was leaf is becoming compost. And if I were to stay there for the winter watching it, which I could if I didn't get cold and hungry, I could see the formation of soil. So here's a little story relevant to the same thing. When I moved house years ago now, I moved house, and I was moving in with a partner. And so we moved everything over. And then the last thing, he had a pickup truck. I said, would he please go back and bring the compost? Because I'm a gardener. Well, he knew where the compost pile was because we used to share taking out the compost from this other house. So he went by himself to do this last task, and he came back empty trucked, saying, I couldn't find the compost. There was only dirt there. I sent him back and I said, that's the compost. It's just a word for the material that when it rots enough, it turns into apparently dirt. Or soil or whatever. It's just words we apply to organisms. Leaf is a name for this part of the living tree, which becomes, in its deciduous, it becomes soil, which becomes food for the next tree. It's not really a separate thing. It's part of the soil cycle, the leaf tree soil cycle. But at one moment it's called leaf, at one moment it's called compost, at one moment it's called humus, one moment it's, you know, organic material. It's the same. It's just stuff. Things turn into other things, turn into other things, turn into... They're not really things, and none of it is separate. They're not really turning into other things. We just give them different names at different stages of their evolution. Everything is like that. So everything is like that. Every person is turning into another one and, you know, becoming... You could be an orthodox person, you could be a radical person. You're just changing, depending on the conditions that are happening for you. Everything in the universe is like that. Not about the universe, but our... certainly system here is this way. Your personality, your views will reflect, you know, what your feelings are, what your experiences have been, what other people have said, what you think about things, and your words and your actions. And they'll all be changing all the time depending on all the influences. So the reason for using this aspect of the Dharma, for keeping remembering this, is to explain why there are certain policies, why there are certain leaders with certain views. They are conditioned this way. If you had, whatever her name was, O'Mallory, I think, Donald's mother's name, and had met the German man who was Donald's father, I don't know what his name is, and had lived in wherever they lived and did whatever they did and had the diet of TV that he's had, you would do the same thing. This isn't a sort of free individual who's just chosen randomly to be a certain way. This is a result of all the influences in his life. For instance, I'm looking at you, Athena, because you're the one who mentioned it, and Athena's from Portland, bringing her Portland anxiety with her. we have you in our hearts. But it isn't just this, you know, one situation. All situations, if we can see them in terms of that everything is lawfully the way it is. It may be awful, but it's lawful, is a great little phrase. It's there because of all of the things that have made it happen, meaning it's consisting of, and it's there because of all the things that have made it happen, therefore that's the law of that thing. Then it helps us accept rather than reject. And the problem is when it's upsetting stuff that's happening and we can't see the conditionality of it, we just take what we don't like and we get upset. Or we get angry, or we get afraid, and we then blame, and we get into conflict. And that doesn't help anything. If we can see that, yeah, that, well, it's there. You know, it's got every right to be that way. Of course it's that way. How could it not be that way? All of the influences have created this to be this way right now. All these people, all of these views. And so we have less argument with it. We still don't like it. We still may disagree and have our positions, but we aren't going to be in one of fight. It's the example that the Dalai Lama is always representing with, you know, the situation with Tibet and China and everything. You know, and he talks about my friends, the enemy. You know, and I mean, so technically the enemy is he's run him out of his country and is, you know, destroying their culture and all the rest of it, not to mention people. And his sadness is that people can do that to other people, rather than they are his enemy and who he's going to fight them, you know. So it's being able to see there that way because this is the way life is unfolding right now. So that, if that's useful to you, I find is unbelievably essential to be able to hold with some understanding, some space, what's going on. That's the second piece. I think that's essential. And then the third piece is to have the courage of our convictions, is to have the strength that comes when you actually really know what's true for yourself. So you have to have the first one and be able to be with it and know how you really feel. And this is not okay to marginalize people or to grab pussies. It's not okay, actually. And so to be able to have the conviction of what's true for yourself and stand up and say it. And that comes from certainty, and that comes from a degree of a conviction, which means being in touch, which is from the first one. Because, again, in these days, it came up in one of our small groups, sometimes we're going to be called upon when it gets troublesome, if it's really difficult, to actually say what we believe. You know, we're nice and we're Canadian and we kind of like, oh well, you know, okay, you know, we don't like to say things. And I don't think we should all go out fighting. I'm not sort of saying raise the banners, but at the same time, if there is injustice, if there is this stuff happening about our planet that matters, that we, you know, we're people, we need to not just turn a blind eye. You know, are we continuing then to support the problem? Are we enabling by not speaking what's true for ourselves? So I think standing up for what's true is actually essential for us. And I think because we practice the Dharma, we're able to develop these skills and be able to see really clearly, more clearly than if we didn't practice, we're able to be this way. We can have some inner strength, some courage. We can actually speak what's really true without engaging, you know, animosity. And we can feel the difficulty and let it really in and really know what it is. I think all these are really essential. And I think the strength that we get from being meditators, having to deal with the world. So those are some words that I have for us about that. And then there's another piece, which is becoming a bit of a thing for me, I have to say, at the moment anyway. Maybe it'll pass. Hopefully it will. But I'm really concerned about screens and devices. I'm getting really irritated about the whole thing. I travel, you know, to teach here and there. And so it's very obvious to me when I'm in airports and stuff. When people are, you know, en masse, there's lots of people, but they're not in their neighborhoods dealing with each other. They're just traveling. They don't connect with each other anymore at all. I deliberately now go and sit down next to somebody who's not on their screen and talk to them just because I want the solidarity of somebody who's an actually functioning person instead of everyone is lost in their screens. I'm really worried. Seriously. We've got such amazing sensitivity for what's going on. We have this orientation ability, our senses to feel and pick up and know what's happening. Well, if you put your attention into one of these screens, you lose that. You lose that. You know, who can sit there like this and know that this person's having a heart attack? You wouldn't even know it. I was telling you about the father and the three children in the hospital. I began with that, didn't I? Talking about giving in your phones. It so impresses me. It so upsets me. So here's a few little pieces of information. I don't know who did this report. Some publications, I think. This is the USA. 94% of adults have high-definition TVs nowadays, and the average adult in the United States spends 4.5 hours a day watching shows and movies. 4.5 hours, the average adult. This other report says, okay, we have about 168 hours in a week, apparently. I haven't counted. We spend more than 50 of those with our devices. This is not talking about people whose work is on a screen, which a lot of people are working. Okay, so the work week takes up 40 hours. We've got 168 hours. So the work week takes up 40 hours if it's a 40-hour week or something. Another 50 hours is sleeping. You know, 7 hours a night times seven, right? That's about 50 hours of sleep, 40 hours of work. And if we assume that all personal care, eating, bathing, dressing, preparing food is 3 hours a day, that leaves 58 hours left over for everything else. Well, if we spend 50 of those 58 hours on a screen, that leaves 8 hours for singing, for talking, for walking, for spending time with friends, with romantic partners, reading, exercising, participating in faith, community, volunteer work, house maintenance, etc. Which isn't good. Is that okay? I'm worried. I think we all need to have mindfulness. We all need to be able to access increasingly our awareness at the same time. And the more hours we spend on devices, the less we can possibly access it. It's hard enough when you don't spend your life on them. But if more and more you spend your time on them, how are you going to be mindful? If you're not mindful, you're not in touch with that part of you that can actually make choices, we're going to be increasingly skillless. Increasingly caught in reactivity, unable to actually make wise decisions. All those beautiful things I talked about yesterday morning will be less and less available. How can that be okay? It's terrifying. We had long discussions about technical stuff at supper last night too, but I really worry about all of that. And I think any way we can... Some people, for instance, I've heard are beginning to put a basket inside their front entrance, inside their front door, which asks people to put their phones in when they come to visit so that they can actually visit or have supper or something. Or in a restaurant, you know, exactly, whatever. Ways of like, okay, over up for our dinner, maybe you have to make it as an agreement. Let's put the phones down and not. I know. I mean, I'm just sort of standing on my feelings about this too, because I've only just started speaking about it, but it isn't just, it's a thing that I think it's a really bad thing because of that inability to have any spaciousness around it. And the other thing that's research-based, is that the impact of information when seen visually is more emotionally impactful than if you read about something in a newspaper or something, because we don't have any access to our own thinking. It's like, it's so consuming that we're very emotionally impacted, which I think is a dangerous thing. I mean, I would like us to have some feelings and not just be theoretical, but at the same time, if there's no space from the information, which is going to upset us, it's going to really upset us. And, you know, without us being able to grow around ourselves and think of conditionality or, you know, empathy or all these other fine things. So anyway, I don't want to get lectury, but at the same time, and I'm sort of preaching not to the youth here, nevertheless, I'm going to start demanding that my family gatherings have no IT in them for long periods. Yeah. So, I mean, I have young adult offspring, right? I have a 42-year-old daughter, a 32-year-old daughter, and a 38-year-old son. And my son isn't doing it very much, but the girls, one of them not so much, one of them a ton of the time. And she's the one with the little granddaughter, you know. Anyway, please.
Yes, I'm sure perhaps some people are aware of this too, but I understand that, in fact, Obama, I think in his last press conference, referred to this, but indirectly, if not directly, the impact various, like Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, on the, whatever you might term, incivility of the American election and how that is creating our verbiage beyond that is being seen as a major factor.
Yeah. Yes, yes. We were talking about that last night too. Joan was mentioning that. Yeah, so anyway, it's let's have some skepticism and some reality and not just be swept along with this sort of apparently inevitable development. Anyway, that's all I can say about it. But I just want to speak it because it seriously concerns me. So thank you for that piece. And so, yes, let's take a few minutes now for some questions about, how you live in the world is one thing, but certainly practice questions, you know, actual meditation technique questions, or what you're experiencing, how you're doing things, or, you know, some of the instructions that I've given you today and yesterday, how did they land for you? Was this not clear? Or what did I mean when I said something? Or you heard somebody else teach something, and what do I think of that? Anything, please. Let's take a few minutes. They're always useful for other people. Yes, please. Jin, right?
More going into the body, accessing the body and walking.
Yes.
Am I imagining stuff when I'm thinking about making it physical in my body, or is that...
Yes.
Yes,
I mean, my attitude is explore for yourself and make it playful and just find out ways to engage yourself for the purposes of training. The purpose is to help us be present, because accessing body awareness is the easiest way, the most accessible way to be present. And we discover that we can be aware of the body and think and laugh and talk, and that really grows. So it's a brilliant, brilliant way of developing our awareness. And playfully is good. As far as using the imagination, it is a skillful way of using the mind to use, like I'm talking about pretending I'm inside my toes, looking out the windows and stuff like this. And it is using the imagination to help me connect. But then I'm actually really being here. I'm not gone. It's not that my imagination is taking me away from my awareness. I'm using it to serve my awareness. And so that's a fine difference, and one has to see for oneself. So, for instance, when people practice metta, especially in the traditional ways, people visualize being with a friend, and then they invite themselves to feel friendly, or may this friend be happy or peaceful. They're all using the mind to imagine this person being peaceful, and so you're using it, but then you're sending those wishes to the person, which is friendly. So you're using the mind rather than being used by the mind. That's the difference. In one retreat I taught, there was a man who hadn't ever practiced meditation. He'd been a working man all his life. He was, you know, retired now. And he said, after I began trying to explain what mindfulness was, he says, "I get it. It's about seniority." And so I said, "Yes, who's in charge here? Is your mind running you, or are you running your mind?" And so that's what you know, is it taking you into zones you don't want to, and it's like suddenly you're thinking a whole lot of stuff you don't want to be thinking, or are you using it skillfully to whatever it is you're doing, calm yourself or soothe yourself or reassure yourself? You're using it then, but then it's in your own development rather than the other way around. Hi.
Louise.
That's right. Hi, Louise. I recognize you so much, but I'm so bad at your name.
And so, not that I'm wishing upon myself struggles, but I find that when I am going through struggles, it's almost easier to meditate because I have this thing to look
Yes.
Whereas when I don't, it's like I can't find the separation or the difference between the thing I'm looking at and the thing that's looking at it. It just seems all pretty gray.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Anybody not here, Louise? So Louise was saying, what about boredom in meditation? It's almost easier to be aware when there's something with a little traction, that's my word, to kind of notice, rather than when there isn't anything particularly disturbing, then it's harder to see the difference between what's happening and awareness of it and so on. So what we do about boredom? Some people say similar things about pain, physical pain. Sitting in meditation, they're much more present when they've got some discomfort in the body than when they're comfortable, for the same reasons. It's kind of like the heavenly realms and the hell realms, and, you know, like the heavenly realms, we could just drift off. It's sort of what you're saying. So when there's boredom, how to be interested is really the question. How to actually be engaged and be here and awake when it's just like dreary. It's about energy. It's not about what's happening. It's about having enough energy. And so when something is challenging, it brings us, we have to rise to that challenge. And so our energy rises to the challenge. There's no challenge. And so the energy doesn't need to rise. So it doesn't bother. And so we board and drift off. So how to rise your energy? So here's a teaching. I was mentioning it in one of the groups this morning. These are so familiar with me now, having become familiar over the years with them, that I use these often. I have to just take a moment to explain it, but you probably already know this, Louise, you've practiced for a long time. There are, in the way the Buddha taught, he had these very clever, clear explanations about how to understand our minds and the different factors going on in the mind. And one of the teachings he has, which is one of the very important one to get to know, is the seven awakening factors, seven factors of our experience which wake us up. And they actually are progressive. And so we do the first three, and then the next four happen in progression. The very first one we have to do, we have to apply ourselves, is what we're teaching. What I'm teaching you is mindfulness, is that accessing that awareness and stabilizing it. The knowing what's happening while it's happening one. Mindfulness. The second one we also do, and it is being curious. So it's called investigation, Dhammavicaya. Wanting to know what's actually happening now, that brightness, which isn't there if there's nothing painful, because there's no reason to have to bother, so it's not working. The third one is energy, sort of applying our energy, how to apply our energy, and the quality of applying our energy, which we learn becomes a sort of persistent awareness that's not trying too hard, but that's not trying too little, that's finding somewhere in the balance of a light, keeping goingness. It has to be light or else we'll get tired if we overdo it, but if we underdo it too much, we'll just won't even be practicing. So it's like refining that energy. Those are the things we do. After which, as it gets sort of in the groove, it's like that, there come moments of like, this is cool. We sort of get enthusiastic. There gets to be this kind of, it's different for different people, but one of the words which I see often in people and know in myself is a sense of delight or liking it. It's just like, oh, this is really, I'm really into this. This is going, we want to do it. We come, you know, we sit, it starts to just optimism, enthusiasm, encouragement, delight. Sometimes we recognize something and go, that's fascinating. When people have noticed something, they've had an insight and they come to me and tell me, there's always this smile. It's like, I never realized I was such a critic. Even if it's a negative thing they're seeing, there's a delight in seeing. Because it's like, wow, I really get that now. My gosh. But there's that feeling of pleasure, that lightness, brightness, that's the next one. And PT is the word for it, and it's manifests in many, many different ways as people meditate, but it's enthusiasm, if you like, or brightness. So that's four. And then number five is serenity. When there's enough enthusiasm, and we have been mindful, and we are curious, and we are gently keeping going, and there's this sense of like, wow, this is cool. It's like it's reassuring and we can relax because it's working and we know what's happening and it's happening, so we can trust it and we relax. Serenity then happens. And then with some serenity, as time goes by and this is more becoming in our systems, then the mind becomes very collected and it's like those puppies start being really well trained and they behave themselves and do what you want. So the mind is now malleable. Concentration, samadhi. And then the seventh factor, which these just arise over time all by themselves, increasingly we find equanimity. And equanimity means that there's a big steadiness and we see the big view and we don't get all thrilled and excited and upset and triggered by things so much. We have much, it's all becoming wah, 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 instead of wah, 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 wah. And so it's easier to cope with it all. So equanimity. So this is an unfolding of our whole experience in a moment, in a lifetime, in a sitting, and so on. So your situation is that there's probably a certain amount of calm and concentration because you've been doing this for a while, you know how to be, you know, but there isn't enough of the first. So when you take, so this is the piece. Mindfulness is the first one, and is absolutely without mindfulness, nothing happens. Then there are three energizing and three calming to make seven. So you put one at the bottom, like a seesaw. It's the base of the seesaw, the fulcrum. Then you put three of the active on one side and three of the calming on the other side. And we want them to be balanced. So if we need a certain amount of interest, a certain amount of energy to apply, and a certain amount of pleasure in it, and a certain amount of calm, a certain amount of collectedness, a certain amount of equanimity to soothe us, and they need to be in balance. If we have a lot of calm and a lot of collectedness, a lot of equanimity, and not very much interest, we're going to get bored. And eventually we're going to go to sleep. If we have a lot of energy and application, and we're trying, like me, I used to be like, okay, I'm going to really do this. A lot of tension, but there wasn't any calm. It's hard to get relaxed. And so I was like getting really tired and working really hard and getting like, I was conscientious, but it took a long time for me to relax. In my experience, I was overlooking the joy piece. Because when there's enough joy, it's like, it's fine. Oh, this is so cool and I can trust it and I can relax. And then the system relaxes. But I was trying to skip from effort to serenity and it was a lot of work. It's way easier to just enjoy yourself and then you'll relax, which took me a long time to figure out. So when there's boredom or dullness or sleepiness, then we need to increase the energy and the interest. You can do mindfulness, you can do curiosity, you can do your energy, you can like adjust your energy to be just gentle and light and, you know, apply yourself, but you can't do joy. Joy just happens or doesn't. Serenity you can't make happen, it will happen. Concentration, collected mind will just eventually become collected. You can't make it happen, and you certainly can't make yourself equanimous. But you can do mindfulness, curiosity, and energy. And so to bring your energy up, usually it's, if assuming mindfulness, because we have to assume there's mindfulness, we need that, is curiosity. And so curiosity then is, you ask yourself questions. And you ask yourself questions which lead you to now and to this experience, not a way into theory or a way into figuring out or a way into the future, but a question that says, what's happening now? Or how is my posture now? Or is there anywhere in my body that's uncomfortable? Or what's comfortable, what's not comfortable now? You should be able to put a now on the end of any question. Or, for instance, this morning I mentioned sounds. When you're hearing sounds, you can hear sounds and silence. You could watch for, I found this very useful. I told it to a group this morning, you can watch for noticing when things begin and end. a sound begins and ends, or an itch begins and ends, or a breath begins and ends. Now start, just notice the beginning of a breath and wait until you really notice the end of the breath. If you stay with the breath, it's going to stop sooner or later, but it's going to fade and fade and get very, very thin, and not, and then it's stopped. Okay, here we go the other way. Okay, it's going to beginning and middle of the breath, it's mostly the middle, and then it's getting less and less and less. When is it ending? That makes you on your toes. It's like, has it ended? Oh, it's ended. And now there's no breath. And here comes the next one beginning. It sharpens up your attention. So there's different ways like that. So, or you could say, are there any hindrances present? Let's see, do I want anything? Am I resisting anything? Am I agitated? Am I dull? Yes, I'm dull. That hindrance is definitely here. Is there any kind of doubting? You just ask yourself questions, what's here and now, to brighten up your energy. That's how you do it. It's how you deal with sleepiness, dullness, boredom. That was a long question, long answer, but it's a good teaching. And so you could just often look, I look in terms of my practicing energy, is it active or is it passive? Is it up or down, too much one way or the other? If it's too this way, I'll ask a few questions. If it's too busy, I'll relax. Just sit back, relax, it's okay. You're seeing enough, you don't have to see more. You don't have to catch every single everything. You can just trust your mind will see what it needs to see. You can just relax. And I sort of back off the energy. And so you're always adjusting in that way. Thanks, Louise. Hi. Yes, the whole, it's a sort of, it's partly it's vocabulary and what we kind of mean when we're saying it and how does it work for you. I would just say before I even begin this kind of thing, it's much more valid use your own understanding of what you experience yourself, do your own practice and find your own way. So no, it isn't that I'm the authority on selfing or non-selfing. I just have to say that first because it all comes clear in eventually. And I say that because that comes out of the fact that in my experiences of meditation, because of the way it was, I lived on Salt Spring, I was a single mom, I was a midwife, on call. I could only take certain retreats in the year, and they weren't retreats by a chosen teacher. They were just retreats that I could afford that were fitting into my schedule pretty much. And so I didn't have access to a regular teacher. So I had a teacher here, a teacher here, different ones, and they had no idea. They didn't know me from anyone else. And so I didn't have any consistent guidance, so I had to just practice. And it was my practice and my own experience that has been my teacher. And over time, I find that it actually fits in well with what the Buddha teaches and what other people teach, but it's because it's self-explored and self-discovered. And that I hugely respect, and I'm really grateful that it was that way, because it's very easy to do what you're taught, but you actually have to make it your own. Okay, so that said, so selfing in the way we teach it here, there is the experience which you experience, and you will increasingly, if you do these practices, you will have those moments when there is an acute sense of being yourself with an agenda, who needs, who wants, who judges, who worries, who imagines, who fantasizes, who runs movies and tells great stories in your head. That's all the selfing behavior. And that has with it, inherently in it, an experience of smallness, tightness, separation, angst, churniness, whatever, however you'd experience that. But the Buddha used a word, dukkha, for that, suffering. It isn't misery, but nevertheless, there's a churning energy to it. We don't know it because it's normal. And so we can't tell. It's just the way it is. But once we start practicing and we start having moments where we're accessing more and more of those sunset moments, there's an absence of that activity going on. And in the absence of it, there's freedom from the dukkha of it. The angst isn't there. Well, if we stay present, we will experience increasingly the difference. And we will recognize our system, not even our brains, but our system recognizes that freedom is freedom from that angsting. And when we're running that angst behavior and what we're doing about that is stressful. And when we're not, it's not. And when we're not, we're actually more in touch with what's true and we're able to behave and speak and act in ways which are more friendly, loving, receptive, etc., all those fine things. And when we're preoccupied with our selfing, our me, mine, and I want this, and I can't stand that, and why would they do that to me behavior, it's not so wise. But you'll see it in your own experience. If you practice present awareness, you will see those coming and going, both. And it's not that we're doing anything wrong in having an ego, but that's how the ego manifests. And we get to recognize it because we more and more have times when we're not in it. When you're in it, you can't see it. It's just like a fish in the sea doesn't know. As soon as a fish is on the deck, it knows perfectly well it's not in the sea and it doesn't like it. So yeah, that's what we mean by self or selfing. So self-aware, when people talk about become more self-aware, they're really meaning what's going on inside. And what's going on inside are moments of tightening and more self-concern and self-preservation and I want, I need. And in those moments when there's more selfing, if you watch and you get to see this, what kind of thoughts are happening? Lots of thoughts, but all those thoughts will have I in them. I want, I like, I don't like, how dare it happen to me? It's all about me. And when we're in a sunset type moment, and there isn't that separate sense of self, there are, A, aren't that many thoughts, and B, they're more like, isn't that beautiful, instead of I want it. Which is why I don't like then people get out the phone to take a photograph. They turn awe into like, I want that. And I'm like, oh, why didn't you just put the phone down and enjoy it? Anyway, that's a kind of... Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, welcome back. Doing a little Q&A. Anyone? Hi, Sheila.
I try to make choices. So,
yeah.
So then I'm thinking, well, she just decided that she didn't need to listen to my point of view. And okay, yeah, the conditions meant that she made that decision. And she had other priorities. But it brought up the question about free will.
Yes, I knew you were going there. It's a really interesting area, the whole thing of free will. How is there such a thing? And how much of it is there, kind of, in conditionality? And the thing is, it's really interesting, there is both. We have some space to choose, but only so much. Because even thinking of choosing, you know, is because of the result of meditating enough to be able to realize you have some choice. Like, I was a childbirth educator, as I told you, and one of the little credos we would say is, I would say to my people, is like, until you know you have a choice, you don't, for instance. And so, yes, I mean, technically, they can choose how they want to give birth, but until you show them that there are options, they don't realize there is any. You know, so we have to actually have learned these things. So you know that you can make some choices about what you speak, but it's called ignorance. Our biggest sin, the Buddha described, what's our problem and why we struggle is because we don't realize we don't have to. We think that barking up the wrong tree will help, and that's why we keep doing it until we realize it doesn't actually work. And so we won't do it then. So in that moment, whoever that person was with you had forgotten that she could have done another thing. She was just caught in the thing she was doing, and so she did it. And you know that's true because you're like that too, because we're all like that. So in any moment, when we just do something, if we stop right after it, then think about it, did I have to do that? Did I make a specific choice clearly when I did that, or did I just do that? And sometimes we are able to have enough awareness that we're choosing it, and sometimes we just do it. Oops. And that's ignorance. It's like ignorance meaning lack of awareness. The awareness part wasn't available, so we're just caught in our automatic behavior. And it changes on a dime in a moment. You know, we can be more present, and then the next moment something just triggers us, and then it's an automatic thing. And we keep going through our lives that way. So this reminds me, I was going to say this, I'm glad you brought it up. Sylvia Boorstein, one of the senior teachers now, she's pretty much retired. She's written a few books, Jewish American grandmother type of, you know, kitchen table wisdom sort of thing. She says, when you meet somebody, and you meet your friend on the street, and they say, how are you doing? There's only one real answer to that, true answer to that, and that is, it couldn't be better. Because if I could, I would. Because if we could, we would be saints. We would. We'd love to be perfect. We'd love to be benign and funny and spacious and wise and totally understanding. We would. And we would if we could. And unfortunately, we can't think ourselves into being, you know, saints. So we do the best we can. Half is, again, one of the lines, a couple of lines from his poem says, there is no one who is not trudging along with as much courage and dignity and style as they possibly can. I love that line. We're all doing the best we can, trudging along, because it's like human realm, you know, it's up and down we go and all these things happening. And so we have some free will. We have some space to make some choices. But those are conditioned choices depending on our conditions, our background, our education, our awareness, our energy, our blood sugar, etc. And then there's the unfolding of things, which is a large degree of inevitability, all those conditions. So we have wiggle room. And that's about as free as it gets. And so the most important piece, because the Buddha taught about karma a lot, and I haven't said anything about that, this retreat is like, we, if we want to have well-being increasingly in our lives, which we all do, that everyone, then we need to make advantage of that wiggle room, not just for ourselves, but because everything we think, say, do is affecting everything and everyone. It's creating part of the conditions of everything else, and that's our responsibility. Our responsibility is to wiggle well, if you like, in our wiggle room and have some consciousness, because that's the best we can do. And if we don't do that small wiggle, then, you know, we can't complain or blame anyone. So let's just keep trying. And it's a humble thing, but it's powerful, because if, you know, every little piece makes a difference, every wiggle. So, yeah, sort of free will. Make the most of what you have. Yeah.
I have an addendum question to that.
Yeah.
It would appear to me, in any event, that we are increasingly in the presence of more and more material choices in our lives, with all these,
gizmos. Yeah.
Yeah, gizmos or whatever. Even picking a water heater, for instance.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's true in other realms, but does that mean that we have more freedom of choice in the material realm or not?
What do I think about that? What do I think? I mean, the Buddha didn't, no one asked him that, at least didn't hear him answer that question. I know, what I do know is true, is that we're more preoccupied. One of the things with having 10 water heaters to choose from instead of one is it takes more time. You know, and so I think that whole consumerism, which is the economy, which is our God, really, you know, the way our world has gone, especially in the last 200 years, is sort of dominating everything else. And it seems to me, it makes our lives too full, and so we don't have the time for reflection. So I think that's one of the problems about being, having all these wonderful choices about these wonderful water heaters. It's very nice to have a warm house. I'm not knocking modern civilization on the one hand, but it's like too much of a good thing. Like, how far do you go? Now, today, I have this little desire to have an automatic vacuum cleaner. I've got a perfectly good vacuum cleaner. It's central vac, and it does a great job. But now I just heard about these things that you can actually, program and go off swimming and come back, and your house will be vacuumed. I'm like, that sounds good. And it's like, wow. I mean, it's where is that? It's always that sort of, it's out there, it's beyond, it's the next moment. And so that's the promise of everything, all advertising, all consumer goods, and it's like, that's a fallacy. It's in here.
Yeah.
Hi. Yes.
In when I practice, I feel so much in my body.
Yes.
And it's there's so much going on. It's so interesting all the time. It's almost
too much. Yes.
And I'm wondering, like, sometimes I have to go, oh, yeah, okay, maybe just, like, focus on
yes. Correct.
But,
that's right.
I'm just wondering if you have any...
Yes.
Does it become too much?
Absolutely. So could you all hear Louise's question? Okay, so yeah, that's the opposite. And it does happen too, energetically, absolutely. And there are sometimes in practice, especially if you do intensive practice for a long period where the mind gets so fine, it sees so much that, for example, I've told this many a time, I remember once in particular, it was funny, I was at IMS in Massachusetts and was sitting, getting very quiet. And I used to do 3-month retreats there, so you get really quiet in long months like that. And so I needed to go to the bathroom. And so the bell rang at the end of the sitting. Sometimes I just sit right through the sittings and keep sitting. But I needed to pee, so I got up when the bell rang. And it took me the walking period to get to the bathroom and pee and back because I was feeling so much. I was so aware of so much that I couldn't. It was overwhelming to move except at a snail's pace. I remember thinking, my God, you can't tell any normal person this. What do you do on retreat? I take 45 minutes to get a bathroom break. But it's because, and it can feel, certainly overwhelm is one word, but overstimulation. There's just too much information. And you can, because your mind is getting so sensitive that you can perceive, there's a million things going on, billions of things, synapses going off, feels sometimes like your whole skin is crawling, and there's just so much going on, inside, outside sounds. And so what you need to do is to do what you do is right, is to just exclude then. You want to exclude, you don't want to be so open. The awareness, our awareness of this flashlight, the way we place awareness, we can actually be very narrow and specific with where it goes, or we can sort of open it up the way you can turn some flashlights into more sort of broad light or specific light, and you can open up the lens more and include more things. And you can have it be completely wide open and let anything be known if you're really present. But usually when we're learning meditation, we can't do that. We'll just be lost in any number of things. So we exclude a lot and just focus in on our anchor. As we get more stable and present, we can include more variety of things without getting lost in them. You're not getting lost and you have that open awareness. So then it's time to protect yourself by zeroing in on something much more simple so that you don't have so much overwhelming information because it's just intolerable. It's pleasurable. Well, then let it be pleasurable. But it's not the thing that we're interested in and we get pulled away from isn't what's happening. It's how am I with what's happening. And that's because ultimately we're wanting, the point of doing all this is to access well-being, the sure heart's release. It's not about what's happening. It's about how am I. And so even if a lot is happening, if it's difficult, then I'm struggling. If it's stimulating, then I'm enjoying. But I'm more interested in what I am rather than what it is. So do this, everyone. You can all do this. Remember this. You'll remember it like this. Put your hand up here, everybody. So your little fingertips are sort of like little scanners, and they're noticing what's happening. In our lives, we tend to do this. Oh, what's happening? It's sunny day outside. Oh, it's raining. There's lots of shoes. Somebody's left their shoes in the middle of the pathway. Oh, no. We want to do this. Flip it back. What's going on in here? This is where my attention is to go, inside my experience. It's not about this. When we don't know to do this, we haven't been taught the Dharma principles that it's your inside that makes yourself happy, not the outside. We believe that ups and downs, if it's up, we're happy, if it's down, we're miserable, and that's the way it is. Well, it isn't. It's actually what's going on in here. And so keep checking, use that situation of a lot of stimulus to check, how am I with this? Is this developing some resistance? Is this developing some attachment? Is this telling me that I'm doing a really great job meditating? I'm a super meditator now. Wow, I'm noticing all these things. Mm-hmm. Not like that other Louise who's missing everything. Or am I simply just noticing that there's a lot of stuff going on? You know, like what? So it's an endlessly exploring what's happening inside ourselves, what's in terms of, as I was saying over here, is this causing more or less dukkha? that sense of struggle or that sense of freedom from struggle? Spacious, ease, clarity. What am I doing? Because it's the way my mind is functioning that's creating one direction or the other. The Buddha called them wholesome, kusala, towards the sense of well-being, or akusala, the other way around. Akusala is unwholesome. You don't have to know how the Pali works, but wholesome or unwholesome, am I leading myself towards more freedom from struggle or more into struggle? That's the ultimate reason we're doing this. But we can't see any of that without having a more stable awareness of what's going on. So the teachings are, the practice of meditation is to develop that ability to look here steadily, ongoingly, in a friendly way. And you'll learn by what you see. Can't do it wrong. Okay, one last question. Hi, hello. Kathy. Yes.
So I went home and wrote it on two of my mirrors that yeah. I would see first thing in the morning, and it really made a difference.
Yes. It's, yes.
Like I look at that and I go, oh, yeah, what is my attitude? Like, oh, well, it's going to be it's this, it's that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it makes me aware.
Yes. Of your own state of mind.
Yeah, and I really like having it there.
Yes. Thank you. What's my attitude? And that particular question, what's my attitude, is from the teacher in Burma, the one I went to study with myself when I was there, Utejaniya. So he uses that phrase. It's like doing this, and it's not just seeing what's going on in my mind, it's seeing, am I adding? It you know, that attitude meaning, do I have a positive attitude? Am I liking, wanting, and am I getting into getting, scheming? Am I resisting, complaining? Do I have a negative thing? Am I turning this into judging? Am I going to get all caught in a whole negative thing here? What is my mind adding to what's going on? Not what's going on, but what's my relationship with it? What's my attitude in my mind? Because it's in your mind that you're going to be happy or not. That's it. All right? That's enough, I think. Chit chat. Thank you.